Hey everybody, this is Stu Smith with another Tactical Fitness Report, and this time I have a good friend of mine, Stephen Robinson, who has a company called Even Pulse, and we will get a lot more into that and what he does. But as you know, I always talk about getting to and through the training, right? And if you really think about it, all that really is just the first two phases of tactical fitness. You have to crush this fitness test to get into your training. You have to train specifically to get through the training or for whatever selection or boot camp or training that is. And then you're an active duty operator. And this is where Stephen comes in, because he has a company that helps us deal with all of the elements that you have to deal with whenever you're active duty first responder. Or it can be dealing with stress from any job, actually. And he'll get into this. But first, before we go into showing you what I'm talking about, Stephen, welcome.
Hey, good morning, Stu. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I kind of framed where we are. So think about the tactical fitness as a spectrum, from phase one being you're a candidate or a recruit. Phase two, you're a student. And then phase three, you're an active duty operator. And whenever you are the active duty operator, let me share my screen. I made this Venn diagram a long time ago to try to explain this to folks. Is, you know, I kind of focus on everything up here. Strength, power, speed, and agility builds durability to get you through the day and, you know, heavy events. You know, your work capacity are all components of aerobic and anaerobic conditioning and muscle stamina. All of that leads to longevity, but you have to balance it out with good recovery and nutrition and mobility and flexibility and sleep. The stress mitigation is really important. And that's where, like I said, is where Stephen comes in with his company Even Pulse, and also goes into the stability side, because there's some job skills and coordination and mindset that's all a part of what Stephen does. So I thought it'd be really good to have him on here and kind of explain to us this bottom half, because everybody knows this top half, because I always talk about the top half, but I don't talk about the bottom half enough, especially for the, the active duty operators and people. You know, you need to start learning this stuff, you know, before you are an active duty operator. So Stephen, what is Even Pulse? Tell us about your company and why'd you come up with it?
Yeah, so Even Pulse is, we call it the science of human resilience. And the reason we developed this is that many years ago, I did debriefs with over 100 special operators, back ranging from the early 80s to the late 90s. And some of the original research I did was around specifically how special operators are uniquely suited for a low-intensity conflict spectrum. And I found that there were a lot of operating characteristics that carried over to my understanding of sports and high performance. But also when I met my wife in 2001, looking at her background in mindfulness and contemplative practices, and beginning to weave some ideas together, we said, hey, we need to go into this field, not just for the military, but for everyone. But we were particularly well-suited for a military national security kind of environment, but also fire rescue and LE.
All right, so who are your customers? You get contracts to go and teach what you teach?
Yeah, primarily from dating back to about 05 DOD. So we've worked pretty extensively with the Army, within SOCOM, a lot of Air Force units recently. We do some work with other government agencies as well. And we've also trained pretty extensively in fire rescue and law enforcement.
Nice. Full disclosure, I actually met Stephen a while back ago, and he hired me to be a consultant for him for a while to teach his Base R training program. If you could, explain to us what Base R is.
Yeah, and you'll see where this ties into your Venn diagram, and especially looking at stress mitigation, but also the on-the-job skills and coordination, life balance, and that sort of thing. So Base R is all around attuning to the body, how we use our mind, how we see the world, how we manage ourselves really as an energy system, and then how we effectively recover it. So it covers five different skill areas, and those include everything from breathing, simulation and recovery, but we tie it together in a package that's really foundational so that the operator or the operator in training can understand him or herself in a way that they're able to more effectively marshal their skills, recover when they need to, and then, of course, longer term, for those of us who've got a few years on them like me, won't say you.
Right. But, I'm there too.
But we've been around the block, right? Mm-hmm. But as you learn these things, many times the feedback we get is people realize as they get older, oh, it would have been great if I had learned that when I was younger and started practicing this. Because it's like anything, you know, you get better at whatever you practice. And these types of skills, well, we're never too old to learn them. The compromise is that when we don't have these skills, and I found this among a lot of the guys I debriefed in the 80s and 90s, they were tremendous operators, but they didn't necessarily have sort of an ecumenical or more holistic life balance and understand how to manage themselves over time. And so that became, they paid a price for that. A lot of them died of coronary heart disease or, you know, other issues at an earlier age than they probably ought to.
Right. So whenever we say stress mitigation, what are your thoughts of helping people mitigate stress? Because that's a big question. A big question, I realize. But, you know, is a part of your program, you know, why is that so important?
Yeah, well, the first thing is stress is something we can't get away from. You know, I think first and foremost, there are a lot of positive stressors. So, you know, when you're training and you're working out, attempting to get stronger to increase your durability, your ability to handle workload, et cetera, all those things are positive stressors because that's moving you towards your dream or your vision. You want to become a Green Beret. You want to become a Navy SEAL. You want to become, you know, a smoke jumper, whatever that might be, but you've got this vision, you're willing to go through a certain amount of stress to get there, to get whatever that plateau or that place is. And then over the course of your life, there are going to be lots of stressors. They may be on the job, they may be off, but one of the ways we frame that is just kind of looking at positive and negative stress, or what we know as eustress or distress. Yeah. And so I'd suggest to your listenership, look at the things in your life that you find distressing, and look at the things in your life that you find sort of energizing, that are things that are pulling you toward things, but those can still be stressful, like when you move into a new house or whatever. But learning to understand that is a big part of the framework. And then look at the things that you find are either potentially overwhelming or they're tremendously draining. And those are usually what we consider a traumatic stressor or something that's you know, on a very high end of the spectrum of a negative stress.
So, let's just go through the base R system real quick, right? Yeah. So it's an acronym, right? So breathing, help me with this because it's been a while.
So breathing is the foundation because it's the first thing you do when you're born.
And why is that so important? Let's talk a little bit about the physiology of breathing. What is happening when you're in a stress state? What can breathing bring to you?
Yeah, so one of the first things that happens when we experience that negative stress or our stress response is we'll start breathing more shallowly and more rapidly. And so that's really the inverse of what we want. Unless we've got to mobilize the energy system literally to run or fight for our lives, people who are in the tactical fitness field really need to modulate a fight or flight response in the sense that they're sending energy specifically to get things done. Or if they've got to evade and escape, okay, well, that's another pathway, but that's still done with control and with focus, with an intent. And I think the problem for the average person is that they go into the fight or flight mode and their energy just basically is dissipated. Breathing well and effectively, getting especially that breath down into the lower third of the lungs, activates the parasympathetic nervous system. And if you're breathing up here in the upper third of the lungs, so if you just right now, just sitting there listening to us, notice where the breath is in your body. Are you getting it all the way down to the lower third of the lungs and filling up that thoracic cavity in all directions? Do you feel the chest rise? Do you feel the lungs, you feel through your rib cage moving out and the chest rising? Do you feel it into your back? Or do you feel just this topping off up here, up high? Because this is where people breathe when they're under high stress. The problem with that is we can only go so long. We're going to reach the lactate threshold faster by breathing shallowly.
Yeah, you get anaerobic quicker.
Yeah. And even it's completely unintentional. You could potentially stay in an aerobic state, but the body goes, well, Stu or Steve's breathing up here really fast. He must need to go anaerobic. So he's getting the hell out of here, whatever he's got to do. And so, but just by breathing more slowly and purposely, you can start to tie that to anything in training. So whether that's, you know, your kid screaming and you get stressed out from that, you slow yourself down with that. You know, your spouse says, I went out shoe shopping. I saved a couple $100. Of course, nobody's shopping right now, but but online they can.
Yeah, it's true. Oh yeah, Amazon is still raking in money. Okay, well, tell me this. When you are in that stress state, you know, sometimes your ability to think clearly is not necessarily occurring. Your breathing can help you engage that thinking and creative part of your brain, right? How is that happening?
Well, I remember years ago, you did a little short video clip that we put on our site about thinking games, and you're doing exercises and you're challenging your body and your nervous system. But I noticed during the course of this, you're stopping and breathing and slowing yourself down purposely with your breath, because really it's kind of the gas and the brakes. Because when you inhale, your nervous system speeds up, your heart rate goes up. When you exhale, your nervous system slows down and your heart rate slows down. So there's this fluctuation, you know, that we know of as heart rate variability of the breath, the beat-to-beat intervals of the heart, but that's governed in large part by how we breathe. And so if you breathe fully and deeply, it helps keep the neocortex online, because we're built to be able to do that. But if you think about the fight or flight mechanism, that's really a lower part of the brain. The emotional or limbic system and the brainstem are going to drive you to either get the hell out of there or fight for your life. But that's not really a cognitive thing. And so what's unusual in tactical fitness is that we're training to try to achieve a level of performance in which there is a high level still of neocortical activity. We're present to the environment, but ideally we're also present to ourselves at the same time. And that's where breathing is such a pivot point.
Right. So what would be your go-to breathing rhythm? You know, everybody talks about box breathing as a method. Do you have another one that you prefer?
Well, the first thing I want to share is, I think the idea of like the technique of breathing is overblown, because most people forget it because they don't practice it enough.
Sure.
I see breathing as really a practice in which you tie that to how you're training in the gym, how you're driving your vehicle, how you're handling your sidearm or your primary weapon system, how you're handling the hose if you're in fire rescue, how you're relating to your kids. So, you know, it's something, the more you practice it, the better you get at it. So that's first thing.
I remember whenever I was first learning this from you, I realized that I do this. I just didn't know why I did it. And I didn't know what it meant physiologically, because before every shot you take with a pistol or a firearm, take that big, deep breath, slow exhale. Boom. Right. So you're actually doing some form of deregulation, you know, whenever you are going through those shots, if you're shooting well, that is. And I would say that was when I had a lot of buy-in to what you were teaching. Right. Because at first it just sounded like a science class I was sitting through. And then and then you started saying, well, here's where it matters. And you were shooting and, you know, in and out of rooms and making all these, you know, discussions that were, you know, tactically, you know, thinking that it really made a lot of sense in that. So a lot of these special operators guys, you know, have these skill sets that they don't even realize that they can also apply to their everyday lives. And that was when it became real powerful.
Yeah. So in terms of specific skills, there are a couple that we teach as go-tos. There are, you know, lots of different breathing techniques. The first one that I would say is probably most important is learning to use the down-regulating breath, what we call the slow-down breath, which is basically extending your exhale at least twice as long as your inhale. So if the listeners right now just takes a slow, smooth inhale, and then with their lips just slightly pursed, you can do that for a long time.
Yeah.
So just by doing that, what I'm doing is I'm purposefully bringing my parasympathetic nervous system online, because in that engaged slow exhale, the expiratory control, I'm getting my parasympathetic nervous system to sync up and link up with how I'm breathing. That's why it's so important. And most people don't understand that.
Yeah, I like that. Let's do this real quick. Real quick definition, parasympathetic, sympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, so your autonomic nervous system, your ANS, you might think of it as your automatic nervous system, really governs all of your subconscious body functions. So the ANS is split into two branches, the sympathetic side, the speed up side, and the parasympathetic or the slow down side. So one expends energy, that's sympathetic. One restores or gains and collects energy, that's parasympathetic. But when you think about the inhale and exhale, those are linked to the heart accelerating and decelerating. And by how you breathe, you're actually toggling between those two sides of the nervous system. In a larger sense, in the wrap of how a tactical athlete would think about performance, you need to get parasympathetic to be able to recover. And sure. So what ends up often happening for your longer-term tactical athlete is that that individual stays sympathetically dominant too often, meaning their nervous system's keyed up and they don't know how to drop into deep sleep and all the restorative side, which is really that's governed by the parasympathetic side.
Right. So it's really kind of a yin and yang system.
Exactly. And, right. And most of us have too much of one, the S and S, or sympathetic, and not enough of the other.
Right. And let's think about other things that we do to sympathetically charge us when we don't need to be necessarily. What are other substances that we do every day?
Here we go. So start in the morning with the Joe. So, you know, naturally, right, your cortisol level is coming up in the morning, which mobilizes energy, right? So naturally, as part of our circadian rhythm, when we wake up, the brain and body go, we're ready to go up into the day. So we do 4 or 5 cups of this. And so that's really, I mean, not for me, but I do a couple of cups of this. That's more than plenty, because the natural rhythm of your system is already moving up anyway.
Right.
You know, there are lots of things that can jack up your sympathetic nervous system. Watching the news, you know.
Yeah, doing that late. Yeah, sports, politics, you know, all of those. That's why they tell you not to watch sports or politics after you've had a heart condition, you know, remedy, you know, open heart surgery or whatever, for quite some time, because it does, it can, what is happening at that moment when we are just, we're sitting down, but then all of a sudden we are pissed off.
Yeah. Well, we're mobilizing the stress response. You know, we start producing epinephrine, and, you know, basically the whole adrenalized response can happen even when we watch an event. Our brain's an amazing imagination machine. So we see stuff on TV, or we just create a story in our head, and we start to get a little bit jacked up, because the body responds as though that's actually happening, because the brain can simulate so powerfully. And that's one reason we teach, and we'll get to this in the ESSA-BASR, but the simulator in the brain is immensely powerful. And people learn skills by watching, you know, when you're a little kid, monkey see, monkey do, you watch mom or dad do something, and then you've got a little expert after a while. Yeah. Just you don't want to curse like driving down the highway, because your two-year-old,
here's where they learn it.
That's mile or two later, they see that overhead sign they pass under. It was just the same place where they heard you drop the F-bomb. And they go, boom, out of the back seat, there it comes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's interesting. That does bring up that memory, doesn't it? All right, so breathing obviously helps us tremendously. Avoiding caffeine late at night obviously is, you know, caffeine, nicotine, alcohol, you know, can help you sleep better and actually get into that parasympathetic recovery state that we're all looking for. So I think we kind of focus on the base, and I guess we can get into the energy part a little bit. So anyway, I don't want to jump too much. So we hit B for breathing, and now A is for
attention. So how do you use your mind and brain on purpose? So if you're, you know, early in the game and you want to, you're reaching toward your tactical fitness goal, you want to become XYZ operator, well, putting your attention on that is a great starting point. Say, hey, this is a really important part of my life. This is my dream. This is my vision. This is where I'm going. And so getting our attention set on this is where I want to go. And then what are the action steps? And this is where, you know, so much of what you teach do is vitally important, of saying, okay, in order to get there, what are the things I have to do now?
Sure.
You know, you were telling me that story about getting to the Naval Academy and being football fit, but not fit for SEAL duty at that point. Sure. And getting specific of what are the things I need to take care of in order to get from here to there. And that's also a big mental construct of having the discipline and being able to regulate one's attention to say, I want this so badly, I'm willing to do what it takes to get there.
Yeah. Willing is that's a big word. Will. Your will is going to come in very handy in your future. And if you have some practice on focusing your attention on this goal, you know, when it comes down to those nights when it's cold and dark and you're tired and, you know, just beat up, uncomfortable, you know, your will is going to get you through that. You know, how bad you want something. But it's also where you sold me on the attention phase of BASAR was the situational awareness and internal awareness, right? Because that made a lot of sense to me because as, you know, guy with some tactical training, you know, being aware of my situation was very important to me. However, I never really thought about being aware of what's happening inside me. You know, why am I all of a sudden fired up? You know, why am I all of a sudden, you know, pissed off at something? What happened at that moment? You know, why is my adrenaline, you know, getting spiked? You know, what is causing that? The fact that I even noticed that I was a good first step. Right. So explain a little bit about external, internal awareness and your attention.
Yeah. So, you know, all tactical operators have some comprehension or maybe a lot of comprehension about what situational awareness means. So it's everything from the skin out, what's in your external environment, and how do I relate to that? The key in our framework is that internal awareness can reflect the situational environment, but it doesn't have to be exclusive. I was talking to a guy. He's a cop down in Southeast Florida. Served in the Navy for a long time, and he said he had never thought about the idea that you could be situationally aware and present to what's around you, but retain a certain amount of internal awareness at the same time. And what I mean by that is, like, as you relate to your external environment, like what's around you in the room right now. So you notice the things that are hanging on the wall, the chairs. Maybe your kids are there or your dog or there's sounds outside or what have you. Can you be aware externally and still feel your current heart rate or feel how you're breathing or what's the level of muscle tension or how you're holding your posture? The reason that's so important for a tactical operator is that you need to be congruent with internal and external. So whatever's presenting out here needs to line up with how you're going to respond in here. So I'll just give you an example. So you're a law enforcement officer and you pulled somebody over in a routine traffic stop, but 2 hours before you had a difficult experience with somebody else on the street, or maybe it was somebody that you dealt with, you know, on the force, maybe it was a boss or what have you, somebody up the chain, a supervisor, and that thing stuck with you and it's still with you. And then as you deal with this person, you find yourself getting pissed off, triggered, or maybe responding a little bit inappropriately, but that individual is not necessarily aware that they're carrying that residue from something that happened 2 hours before. And that's where that internal awareness is going to lead to better decision-making, has implications for use of force issues, the list goes on and on. So just tuning into that, it's a lever and it's powerful.
Yeah, that's very powerful. And you know when you're starting to get good at it, is when your internal awareness is able to tell you that there is external, there's something in your external situation that you may not have seen, you may not have heard, but your senses have picked something up. It has picked up some kind of a vibe or a feeling that may have gone right past your conscious, but your subconscious picked it up and it caused that internal awareness of like, there's a threat here. You just don't see it yet.
Yeah. The vagus nerve that innervates in the face down through the throat and voice box into the heart, the lungs and the gut has 100 million neurons in the plexus of the gut. And so what we often think of is gut instinct or intuition is actually partly a physiological phenomenon because the vagus governs our sense of safety. And so when we're attuned to our external environment, but also our internal environment, we're actually smarter in many senses because we're picking up a lot of things. They could be very subtle cues in the environment that are conveying a threat, but our body's saying, hey, bro, you need to be listening to this because this is going on over here. I want to give you a quick example. General Wilson, Sam Wilson, who I studied under for many years, he was deputy director for Central Intelligence for CIA, long time. He was a career special forces operator who sheeped it back and forth into the IC, intelligence mm-hmm. community. He told me a story about being in mm-hmm. Burma in World War II. And so he was out on point, and they were in the Burmese jungle. He was with Merrill's Marauders, the 5307th Provisional. Yeah. And so he said he all of a sudden heard a voice in his head say, "Duck, Sam, duck." And he dove to the ground, his face planted, and a 6.5 millimeter Nambu cut the bush right over his head. He would have literally been cut in half. And he said, "How did I know that this was happening?" And he said, "You know, I just listened to this voice," but he said, "Something in me," you know, he didn't know about the Vegas at the time, but I remember years later having that discussion with him, and I was like, "Hey, General Sam, your vagus nerve picked up something. It might have been the smell of fish sauce. It could have been, you know, a subtlety in the foliage where there was a differential between the Japanese uniform and the green. Who knows?" But something told him that, and boom, his consciousness said, "Face plant," saved his life.
Damn. Yeah, that's a powerful one. So what are some skills that or ways to practice being more, getting in tune with the internal external awareness? What are some habits that you can do to practice getting better at those?
The first thing I suggest is just notice what you notice. Do a little body scan and make that an intermittent part of your day. Just like, you know, your computer can run background scans on itself. You're looking for malware. You're running an app in the background. Your app can become this process of scanning up and down, and particularly looking at where's my attention gone? Because you got to be aware of where it's going to be able to rein it back in and send it where you want it to go. Thought stopping is a great technique. So as an athlete, you're a fellow athlete. I know for example, I would be my own worst enemy. I was a tennis player for many years, which I consider one of the most manly of all sports. But yeah, seriously, tennis is a tough game.
When you play tennis against someone who's really good at tennis, it's embarrassing.
Yeah. But believe me, I got embarrassed many times out on the court. But seriously, when we look at sports, for example, or for that matter, anything that's challenging you, that internal voice, the internal dialogue, is often detrimental to our performance. So that voice, which we sometimes call the imposter or the pretender voice, will tell you all the reasons you can't do something.
Yeah, I call it the quit demon.
Yeah, the quit demon. That's another great way to put it. And it's this little voice. It's like it's sitting on your shoulder, like your conscience going, "No, you can't do that. You know, you suck," or "This is not going to happen. That's impossible." You know, whatever it says. And you can either listen to it and go, or you can say, "Hey, thank you, but shut the up." Yeah. And that's stopping those thoughts. And then you're redirecting your attention and saying, "Hey, whatever that was, I don't need you right now. I'm sending my attention where I want it to go."
Yeah, I heard a great quote the other day was, "Don't listen to yourself, talk to yourself."
Yeah.
Yeah, especially in those moments like you're talking about. Yeah.
The most powerful voice you'll ever hear, other than maybe a parent voice that's stuck in your head, is your own. And a lot of times what we hear is a reflection of what we heard growing up, maybe from our parents or from somebody else, mm-hmm. that basically got implanted like a software bug. You talk about virus. It's like the virus of our own thinking. Ezra wrote a blog called "Is Your Thinking Infected?" And it's because we practice a lot of times thinking things that, you know, we might think of as stinking thinking. And we're not aware enough to go, "Hey, just because it's a thought doesn't mean that's who I am. And I'm not going to listen to that."
That's a good point. So you call this thought stopping. Thought stopping. Okay.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. So there are a lot of techniques you could use. You can blow up a thought. You can wipe it away like you're wiping off a wipe-off board.
There you go.
Literally blow it away. Whatever you want to do, whatever kind of metaphor, image, symbol works for you. But realizing that you're in charge of your thoughts and you can redirect them is a really, really powerful understanding.
So I like that you kind of take action against that thought in some manner. So you kind of tie a verb to getting rid of that thought. You are blowing it away, kicking it away, blowing it up, you know, whatever that is, or just ignoring it, you know, complete like dissociate and just, you know, focus so much that it goes away.
Right. And that's where you might use some sort of affirmative technique, like right now, power on, you know, powering on through this. You know, you're in the midst of a training process. Your muscles feel like they're starting to fail, but you're trying to milk another rep, another set out or whatever you're doing. that's where you're putting your attention on what's powering me up to keep going. It's letting go of that intrusive thought, which many of us have, and saying, hey, right now, this is where I'm heading.
So is this where the performance cue comes in?
Absolutely. So performance cues, you and I talked about that years ago. Mm-hmm. That's a way of basically engaging your abilities to maximum effect by locking in something that cues your attention to high performance. So it might be right here or right now or game on. It doesn't have to be words. It might be a symbol or an image. You know, maybe that's, you know, you're wanting to get through buds and you want to have that trident pen. You know, so there it is. So maybe that's your symbol.
Yeah.
And so no matter what, that's there for you. Or it could be a feeling state. So there are lots of different ways that you could use a performance cue, but I encourage people out there listening, think about something that cues you that says, I can get through this workout, or this is where I'm going, or this is how I want to get, you know, get to that kind of game on point that brings the fullness of my capabilities in the moment.
Yeah, I always found a phrase is very helpful, you know, like train to compete, let's go. You know, game on, let's roll. Those are classics. So I guess the next question would be, when we're talking about performance cues and attention, you got any other topics on keeping attention or making it better before we move on to the S part of BASAR?
Yeah, I would say train your mind and brain, because if you don't run your brain, it will run you.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is that so much of our imprinting is subconscious. And I don't mean that in like some sort of mystical sense, but I mean the limbic system and the brainstem, the emotional brain and the lower brain, and including the cerebellum, are encoded with a lot of what we've learned physically. Our sense of balance, largely governed by the cerebellum, the vestibular system, of course, ties in. But there's a lot of imprinting in our brain that has a strong emotional content that's not necessarily serving us right now where we are as adult human beings. And so that's where learning to parse your attention and challenge it. Literally, you're going to train the synaptic connections in your brain to function in a more optimal way by continually directing your attention.
There you go.
Your brain gets better at whatever you practice, essentially.
All right. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. All right. So S part of BASAR, simulation?
Yep, simulation.
Right? Yep.
So, yeah. And so it's kind of our euphemism for the use of imagination or visualization. But the way we frame it is it's more than just like this kind of idea of mental rehearsal. Mental rehearsal is really powerful because I'll just give you an example of that. One of our guys, you've met him before. He was a Special Forces guy, still is an SF guy. He was training for a marine amphibious course. It was actually out at Coronado. And so they had to run the obstacle course that's there on the beach in Coronado. So
nice.
The Bud's obstacle course. So being a smart guy, he went online and he watched videos of that entire obstacle course.
Yeah, there's some dude with a GoPro doing the whole thing. So yeah,
right. And so that's what he did. So he took himself first person through it. He memorized it. He did some fitness work to prepare himself for it and rehearsed every part of it, went out there and smoked it.
Smart.
So that's a simulation.
That's a hard one to do first time. First time, yeah. It beats you up.
Right. But if you've already been there in your mind, your brain and nervous system and body are less surprised.
Nice.
And of course, that's one of the ideas behind training and everything, whether it's in special operations or fire rescue or LE, the simulations prepare you for the as if. Now, the way I want to pitch this to your listenership is to think about what are you simulating in your life and what are you trying to get better at? Is that listening skills? So you're improving your relationship with your spouse or your kids? Is that you developing a specific technical skill that's ideal for your field? A lot of it has to do with where you're at and where you are in your career cycle, but looking at simulation as an opportunity to grow and get stronger, the brain has an incredible emulation capacity. And we know that the mirror neurons that are mostly in the left frontal cortex are responsible in part for how we relate to what we're trying to do. And that's what always impresses me. People who push the envelope of performance often go places where nobody has ever been before. And so how do you simulate doing something that nobody else has ever done before?
Yeah.
That's actually using imagination to see something new.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, to keep that creative thinking part, you know, alive, it takes practice.
Sure.
You know, especially when you are tired and winded, because that is the first part that goes. You know what I mean? When you're starting to really, like we talked about earlier, you're really starting to get winded and you're getting tired. Some of the first parts to go is this thinking part of the brain. And, you know, one of the skills I like to do sometimes with folks is, you know, we're doing a hard workout and then I stop everybody and I put a flashcard, like elementary school flashcard, right in front of them. And I don't prepare them for any of this, you know, and it might be like 5 times 7. Right. And they're looking at it like, they got to take a minute to, like, you know, come online. Right. Sure. It's not something that they can look at like when they were a kid and say, oh, 35, you know, but it actually takes them a minute. And to ask them a question about history, even funnier, like who's president of the United States. Right. Or who, first president, second president, it, you know, really throws them, you know, but, you know, anything. You know, anything like that, that is just basic knowledge that is stored in the brain, but it is shut down whenever you are really jacked up.
Well, I think you're hitting a key point too, that for the tactical operator, understanding that you really need to function with all the levels of your brain engaged. You can make critical decisions, field decisions, while you're out there, but the brain's remarkably efficient. It's trying to shunt the blood flow to the lower parts of the brain because that's where it needs to live at that point. And so your brain's not assuming that it needs to have neocortical function so that you're, you know, solving a complex math problem or you're thinking through a set of issues. And that actually takes training. You've got to train your brain to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. And you can do this through the simulation phase.
Yeah. And I mean, there are a lot of different simulation skills that we teach. You know, everything from a basic skill acquisition to modeling. You know, you and I were talking about that a while back of looking at people that you look up to or respect and basically taking from the outside in, what are the qualities that they project? What are the things that they do? What are the things that they have inside of them that I want to emulate, that I want to be more like? And then how would I experience that if I had those things? And so that's an idea we call covert modeling, where if I say, you know, hey, Stu's very fit and I'm using you as a model, you're more of an overt model.
Sure.
Like, okay, here's somebody who's got discipline. He gets up every morning, he trains. That's a way that anybody can use modeling to get better.
Yeah. You know, sometimes you have to see it to believe it. I always like to say, and you know, you see somebody doing the things that you want to do or have done the things that you want to do. It takes away that impossible option, right? He's doing it. It's not impossible. Why can't I do it? You know, right. Yeah. It's very, very powerful tool. I remember probably one of the reasons why Naval Academy kids do well out at SEAL training is, you know, you're there for 4 years at the Naval Academy. You've seen three classes before you go into these jobs that have an 80% attrition rate, and then they're all finishing. And, you know, a few of them every now and then don't make it, but, you know, for the most part, you know, most of them do. And it takes away that impossibility factor of your next step, you know, going through a selection program. So, you know, that's a big, you know, that type of simulation. And like I said, seeing it to believe it is very powerful.
Yeah. Well, those people have already broken whatever that glass ceiling is. So they've been a place you want to go. And, yeah, I have lots of models, image models in my life of people who are great teachers and leaders, thought leaders, et cetera. And I look at them regularly and say, okay, what do I need to practice today to be more like that?
Right.
And even if it's a real, real simple thing, putting one foot in front of the other, or maybe stopping to appreciate things or getting more quiet inside so I can listen more effectively, whatever that is.
Now, I think one of the neatest things you had shared in this phase of simulation was the name it and tame it skill.
Yeah, that kind of, it crosses over between the S and the E.
Right.
But you know, when you see or experience difficult things, one of the skills that we teach is called name it and tame it. And the reason that's important is that the limbic system, the emotional midbrain, is where we have basically our emotional responses to life. And, you know, we're, of course, emotional beings, no matter how much we want to suppress that or push it down, you know, emotions are a big part of what carry us forward. In my book, I think people who are successful in all walks of life tap into and they give from an emotional space. Like, you know, for me, my passion of doing my work is I'm giving with that emotion every single day. Right. If I just give with my body's going to get depleted. But the emotional piece is part of that inexhaustible fuel that you've talked about as being that fuel in your tank when nothing else seems to be there.
Yeah.
And it might even tie over to what we think of as spiritual too, but there's something deep that we can draw on. The name and tame it skill is really built around learning to name and tame negative emotions that are not useful in the moment.
Okay, so we're going to move into energy then. So it's kind of a simulation for me, but it's also, and it really helps you with energy. So let's explain how that works. And E is the, you know, the acronym letter for energy and base R. So we're down to E now.
Yeah, and we're energy machines. We convert food and fuel into energy. You know, we restore and recover overnight, hopefully by getting good sleep. Therefore, we're going to have more energy, water, hydration. There's so many things that modulate us as an energy system. The way we frame this, Stu, is that we look at the body, brain, nervous system as an energy system, but our emotional component of it is vital to how we function, how we relate to our families, how we relate to our job, et cetera, our passion for what we do. That even boils down to heart rate variability and how our heart functions.
Oh, yeah.
The name it and tame it skill specifically is around reining in your negative emotions. Like, I feel frustrated, I feel pissed off, I feel sad, I feel disappointed, whatever that is.
Unproductive, yeah, whatever.
Unproductive, I feel like a lazy sack, whatever. But by naming the emotion that goes with it, we actually will shunt blood flow from the right amygdala and the midbrain on the right side, right hemispheric side, to the left frontal cortex. And you can see this under a functional MRI, some of the work that University of Wisconsin has done, and also specifically work that UCLA did on studying emotional responses. All they had to do was show someone very negative, distressing images, and they had a response in the right amygdala. All of a sudden, sugars are going there, there's blood flow and activity, boom, right amygdala lights up. So for those who don't know, we have two amygdalae, the right and the left, and the amygdala, almond from Latin, is basically the trigger for our fight or flight system. It's really an emotional trigger, generally fear associated, but it also has a lot of positive associations, including sex. So you don't want to get rid of your amygdala if that gets calcified or ruined. It kind of ruins some other things too.
Sure.
But your amygdala is a tripwire system, and you can actually tame it by naming whatever that emotion is. And so that's bringing Broca's area on in the left side of your brain. And as soon as I name frustrated, it doesn't mean I'm carried, like, I'm so frustrated. Like, that's not it, because you're getting carried away by the emotion.
Yeah.
If I go frustrated, you'll see on a functional MRI, the blood flow shunts over here to the left frontal cortex. So that means the neocortex is now online. You're observing an internal state, which they call an interoceptive process, and you're down regulating or taking the blood flow and sugars away from this right amygdala.
Nice. You know where I use it is, I write for a living. And sometimes I have a deadline that I got to reach, and I'm sitting upstairs, and I do all my writing downstairs in my basement office. I'm sitting upstairs and I'm kind of hemming and hawing, you know, I am procrastinating. And as soon as, you know, my wife's like, what's going on? What are you doing? I said, I am procrastinating. Right. And I just said, I'm just procrastinating, right? And so that little thing right there helps me to start focusing a little bit better, you know, because before I say it, I'm like all over the place, and, you know, I realize I'm procrastinating, but until I say it, you know, I can act, and then not only say it, but hear myself say it. That's really powerful, right? Like you said, it starts putting things online, and I'm able to get things done, and within 5-10 minutes, I'm starting to write again. Another way I use it is, when my kids were little and they'd have a bad dream, I said, so tell me what happened. You know, there's like this big guy was chasing me. And I was like, yeah, you know, let's call that guy Booger Eater. Right. And I was just like, and then he'd laugh. You know, my son would say, okay, he's a booger eater. Right. And then we started laughing about it. And then, yeah. So now whenever you think about that, just say booger eater. Right. He's a booger eater. And, you know, then we get to laughing about it. We come up with a silly name for it. So I said, you know, basically we just named it and tamed it, and completely just changed his whole mindset on it. And he could fall back to sleep in a few minutes, you know, so.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, and what you did too right there is you tied together simulation. So you're creating a different outcome. So turning the boogeyman into booger eater.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, like for you on procrastination, taking the attention piece and taking a scattered attentional state. And, you know, maybe for a little while you need that, because, I mean, there is some scientific evidence that kind of letting the mind and brain float a little bit can be really helpful to harvesting energy and getting productive. But then to rein it in, you know, naming and taming is not so much the emotional side. You were using that as an intentional technique.
Yeah,
and all of BASAR kind of fits together, because you can't really.
Yes.
You can work with them in each area, but it's really an integrated model, and you'll figure out after a while as you start to practice this. No matter where you come at it from, it all leads back to one place, which is you.
Yeah, I like to think of BASAR as a circle of letters, right? You got B, A, S, and R in the middle.
Right.
You know. So, yeah. So I guess we're on energy now. So what is What is important about this phase, the energy phase?
So, you know, this is how we get stuff done. And it's also important to pay attention to the emotional side of it, because this opens up the whole portal to looking at emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you want to have a survivable and thriving relationship with your spouse, like knowing, for example, that about a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative comms with your spouse is a secret to a successful relationship. If you're less than that, at least what John Gottman has studied, and I can't remember the guy's name, David Rausch, I think he wrote a book back in like the early 70s, looking at this relationship ratio, those relationships generally fail.
Wow. So 5-to-1.
So you got to keep that positive ratio, 5-to-1. If you're inside of that,
you're constantly bitching at something. You need to settle.
And even some couples who bicker a fair amount, as long as they maintain that high ratio, they'll generally succeed. So, you know, energy is kind of a portal to understanding yourself emotionally, but even at the level of your heart rate variability. You know, one reason I'd encourage people to work with how you sleep, managing yourself effectively, and being able to get parasympathetic, including by breathing deeply regularly, is that you're managing your HRV. The studies that were done back in the 80s and early 90s on special operators, a lot of them actually over time developed very low heart rate variability, which of course corresponds with coronary heart disease, various other health issues. And it's because that beat-to-beat interval of the heart gets compressed when naturally the wave is wide from sympathetic speed up to parasympathetic. So if it gets down into this like low HRV, almost like a metronome that's steady, boom, 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 that's usually going to correspond with a level of autonomic nervous system regulation that's poor. And over time, that individual gets compromised.
Hmm. Damn. Okay. So that is... that's one definitely good reason why we need to mitigate stress for just pure longevity reasons.
Yeah. And, right? And also
chronic stress becomes deadly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, often we think of that around post-traumatic stress. And of course, you know, significantly imprinting issues can be very powerful, and they basically also lodge in the subconscious, which I think of as largely our body. You can think of your body as your subconscious mind or brain. But then on the chronic stress side, that's where a lot of our quality of life gets eroded. You know, relationships get eaten away. And gradually, our performance degrades, because it's kind of like cooking in a slow soup. And over time, it's like you're on this simmer long enough, your nervous system's not really built to be able to handle that.
Okay.
So you got to learn how to recover. And the E part is a big part of that.
All right. So what are some of the things that you use to explain this energy? You know, when you're teaching the energy portion of BASAR?
The first and foremost is relating it to your autonomic function and connecting it to heart rate variability.
Okay.
And so if you understand that, then you've got that portal to understanding your autonomic nervous system, and you've got the whole relationship between performance on one side and recovery on the other, because that boils all the way down to your A and S, speed up and slow down.
Right. And you've already explained the internal awareness segment. Because being able to be aware that you have this energy all of a sudden and why you have it is a big part of this chapter.
Exactly. And even within E, you know, looking at the attentional side, recognizing where your attention's going is going to either contribute to your level of energy or take away from it.
Right.
So if I'm focused on things that I'm frustrated or pissed off about, well, I'm getting better at that. So I'm actually putting my attention on things that I'm frustrated and pissed off about. So therefore, my brain gets more potentiated. It's actually growing more neurons to help me get better at that more often. Yeah. Now, if I focus my attention on something I appreciate, and I go, I appreciate my family. I appreciate that I've got a roof over my head. I appreciate that I've got a job. I appreciate that my job could help save people's lives. You know, whatever you're appreciating, your brain also gets better at that. And yeah. So that becomes your state more often, even in high stress, high stakes environments. You know, you can appreciate a lot of things, even on a mission, for example.
Sure.
Appreciate the decision of your team.
Yeah.
What you're doing it for in the first place.
Yeah, that's a good one. I've always said that you get good at things you do, but you also get good at things you don't do. Meaning you get good at not doing them.
Right.
You don't get good at them because you're not doing them, but you get good at not doing them, if that makes
sense. Like procrastination you mentioned. Yeah. I've known lots of procrastinators and people that we think of as lazy or they don't get stuff done. Well, they've practiced long enough at being good at procrastination. They're an expert at it.
Exactly. You know?
So exactly. I don't think I want to be an expert procrastinator, but it's like, if you kind of take stock of how do I send my energy in my life, that's, you know, it can either be a catalyst to where you want to go, or it can be a sandbag that you're carrying around.
Right. So I remember one of the big things I remember when we were teaching some of the folks in the Army, this one, and you could see all of them staying awake with monsters and dip and, you know, whatever it was, you know, smoking during the breaks. Let's talk about, you know, some of the substances we put in our body and what that is doing to our energy, you know, and hormonal response to those as well.
Yeah. So specifically we touched on in the training, not just with the Army audience, but with a lot of people we train to look at smoking, drinking, and caffeine. Now, there are lots of things that we can take into our bodies that modulate our energy, including food and water. So those are big too. But just looking at what are the kind of substances we use to really, really kind of toggle or modulate our energy, you know, drinking, very common in special operations, in the military culture, fire rescue, LE, and that's sort of bringing a lot of people down at the end of the day. And of course, the reason people are drawn to that is it actually tones down the right amygdala. So if you look at somebody under a functional MRI after a drink or two, the amygdala will start to tone down, takes the edge off of it. Sure. Same thing with smoking. Whether it's nicotine or weed or anything else, people smoke because it tames the right amygdala. That has all sorts of other effects too.
Sure.
But for a moment, there's a calming effect on the nervous system. The downside of that is that once that wears off, the desire for more goes up because we're now addicted to or using that substance to try to get the state to happen.
Sure.
But also the state that they're trying to lay down returns in spades. So if they feel anxious, they start drinking, or they feel anxious, they start smoking. Automatically, as soon as that substance is abating, the energy state will start to come back up in a more pronounced way.
Right. And our number one recovery tool being sleep, you know, with the excess caffeine later in the afternoon can definitely interfere with your sleeping at night. You know, the nicotine, the alcohol, if you really overdo the alcohol, then you don't really go into that deep sleep that is restorative. You don't go into that rapid eye movement sleep, which is critical to recovery. So that completely affects your energy.
Absolutely. And, you know, whatever you take in into your system, it's going to affect your energy system. So the more you can get there without anything that's from outside of you, anything exogenous that you're taking in, you know, like this coffee, half-life of caffeine is 96 hours.
What?
So, yeah. So if I take in 100 milligrams, well, 96 hours later, that's still in my system.
Wow. It's
processing out over time. So, you know, I was talking to this staff sergeant years ago, Army guy, and he was like, Steve, how much caffeine is too much? I said, well, how much are you drinking there, staff sergeant? And he's like, I don't know, 8 or 9 cups a day. And he's like, you could just tell how jacked up his nervous system was. And I was like, hey, so, you got to take an edge off this. And maybe just stop drinking coffee earlier in the day or start cessating like it, you know, maybe starting at 1600 or 1500 and just start gradually backing that up. because you got your nervous system so jacked up. He's like, I can't sleep. It's like, yeah. Hey, Jeff, no wonder, bro.
Yeah. Yeah. I have found that a big thing of water. I'm a tea drinker, so I'll drink iced tea. Drink a tea, drink water, drink a tea, drink water, drink a tea. And I used to do that till probably about mid-afternoon, and then after that, it's just water. And that has been a helpful process. And I can put my head on the pillow and fall asleep. So I'm pretty lucky with that process. So yes, sleep is our number one recovery tool, right? And we are getting into R, which is recovery, how is it that you tie it all together to recovery?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different themes I think that are really important around recovery. You've already hit sleep. That's your number one ally for recovery. So if you're not sleeping well, you want to look at a couple of things. You know, one, what are the things I'm taking in? Not just caffeine, but what am I taking in the way of news? Do I have a strategy of how I approach going to sleep? So am I telling my brain and nervous system, it's time to walk it down. It's time to head toward La La Land. And you have a process that you go through. Is your room darked out? So do you have ambient light that comes in from somewhere? Are there noises that you might be able to mitigate from outside? Or maybe you put in earplugs or you use an eye mask, a combination of things. The darker and more quiet you can keep the room, the better. Generally backward plan your sleep. So like, you know, this morning I knew we were going to get on this podcast. So I like to get up and I got certain rituals I do in the morning. So I made sure I was up an hour and a half before our podcast or our Zoom call and backward plan how many hours can I get from the time I'm going to hit the hay to the time I'm going to get up in the morning. And then I'll look at, okay, we sleep in about an hour to 20 to an hour 40 minute cycles, about an hour and a half average, right? So you want to look at how many sleep cycles can I get? Is that 4? Is it 5? Is it 6? Now, some of you out there listening go, well, 6 times an hour and a half, that's 9 hours of sleep, bro. I've never had that much sleep in my life. Or maybe when I was 13, I slept that long.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah. But the thing is, in the tactical performance field, you still need sleep and you need to sleep well. 6 hours, I would say, is an absolute minimum.
Absolutely. Yeah, six hours minimum.
And yeah, like we've done a lot of work with Air Force security forces lately, and I just kind of like, you know, softly interview, but also we do a lot of, you know, data assessment stuff too. And a lot of guys are getting 4.5-5 hours a night. And I was like, hey, you know, since you guys are Air Force cops, do you know that essentially you are functionally drunk on the job? Because you go 18, 20 hours without sleep, it's like you're into like one or two cocktails of the equivalent of cognitive performance, because it begins to degrade and erode your performance. Yet your brain will tell you that you are functioning just fine. You know, I look over at Stu and go, hey, bro, I'm fine. But, you know, the brain has come adrift from its moorings. It's like floating off into Never Never Land. And, you know, part of the problem is that we're hardwired to try to assess that we're fine even if we're not. And without sufficient sleep, your performance is going to degrade. But guess what? Your immune system goes down, your ability to recover, your ability to gain strength, the way you train, everything affected by how you sleep.
Yeah, let me share this with you. I came up with this a while back ago, and it is unscientific, but it's pretty true. But if you think about it, I mean, if you focus on nutrition and sleep, you're probably going to be about 90% there with your recovery. The other 10%, I like to call it the missing 10%. You can, you know, and this is more of a physical recovery than anything else, but, you know, your ice, your heat, your stretching, your mobility, what kind of gear you have, you know, massages and, you know, other type of outsourcing services that you can do, acupuncture, you know, whatever. You know, those are kind of like I put in the missing 10%. But if you really want to look at your recovery, if you just focus on sleep and nutrition primarily, and then, you know, play around with whatever works for this middle 10% for you, you're going to be in a much better recovered state.
I would totally agree with you. I mean, whether there's specific science on that or not, like a 90-10 rule is a great ratio because you're taking care of really the fundamentals. Yes. Sleep on one side is your master recovery. That's your whole parasympathetic flow. And on the food and water side too, you're really nurturing your parasympathetic system. And even like stopping and slowing down in how you eat. I was working with a group of cops a while back. And one of the things I joke with them about is like, all you guys take like an hour and a half lunch every day, right? And while you eat really mindfully. And then at the end of the lunch, you take a little nap and you reset yourself. And they're all laughing. They're like, yeah, because that never happens.
Yeah.
They got 15 minutes, they kind of stuff it in their face and then they're on to the next thing.
Yeah.
But even if you can learn some little micro recoveries, now here's an idea around recovery. What are the ways during the day that you can slow yourself down just a little bit? Even if it's in how you eat, and whether that's maybe saying a prayer before you eat or purposely slowing your breathing down just a little bit.
Breathing is number one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, just slowing yourself down. And then eating with a little presence, so you're not just like mindlessly chewing, yakking with the dude sitting next to you, and paying attention to your food, because you're actually getting your parasympathetic nervous system engaged, which means you're going to process the food more effectively. So there's a big part of the recovery process.
Right. You know, that's a really good point, because digestion is definitely affected by those two nervous systems. You know, if you're sympathetically charged, what is happening to your digestive system? Right.
It turns off. Yeah. As soon as your brain perceives threat or stress, you know, the body is super efficient. It'll try to turn off anything that doesn't need to be happening. And so your whole parasympathetic system, which is governed by this vagus nerve, as soon as the brain says you can't relax, vagus cuts off, sympathetic side jacks up, you can't digest your food.
Yeah. And, you know, what is very common in a lot of tactical athletes, people in the tactical professions, is, you know, gastrointestinal issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So gut issues are huge. It's not just the big gut that sometimes guys get from, but that can actually be a function of inflammation too. So not just accumulation of body fat, but the internal organs become so inflamed because they're not really working efficiently. And so what happens after a while is we just keep stuffing stuff mindlessly into our face, but not thinking about what we're eating, how we're eating, and what's eating us inside.
Yeah, very, very important. So with that one sentence that you just said, you just kind of put all base R right into one little sentence, which I really enjoyed. What would you say your go to number one recovery technique is? What is it that Steve Robinson does just to take the edge off of the day?
Yeah, the most powerful thing that I use is extending my exhale and paying attention to the breath. You know, one of our trainers asked me a few weeks ago, he's like, how often do you pay attention to your breath? And I was like, every 10 minutes. So there are all sorts of things that remind me of that. Chimes go off of my computer, I cycle my breath. If you're on the radio on comms, cycle your breath. Your kid starts crying, cycle your breath. As you keep going back to it, it becomes automatic, because if you can master that, you're regulating your nervous system throughout the entire day.
Nice.
So over time, you accumulate like a bank account, this buildup of your brain and body knows what it feels like to have a regulated nervous system. It's a lot easier to go to sleep at night. And the other thing is, you know, back to your 90-10, I pay a lot of attention to what I eat and how I feel after I eat it. And then I've really focused on sleep, backward planning the sleep every single night. I do my best to get 7.5 to 9 hours. You know, if I know I'm going to be on the light side of that, 7.5, if I got to get up early and take a flight, which, you know, we'll return to that at some point soon.
Sure.
You know, I'm still going to try to get at least 6 hours. Worst case scenario, I'll get 3 sleep cycles and get that 4.5 hours. And then when I get to wherever I'm going, I'll try to take a nap or try to get to bed really early that night to get a little catch-up time.
Right, right. Yeah, sleep is critical for recovery. Like I said, it could even be more than 50% important. I don't know. Like I said, I just made a little pie chart and put some stuff together, and it took me about 5 minutes to make it. But, it wasn't a lot of science to that other than just my personal experiences and recommendations and what recovery is.
Well, the last thing I want to leave with on that is, if you prioritize your sleep and you prioritize recovery, and you recognize from a high performance standpoint that if you recover well, you're going to enhance your performance. You're going to enhance your career longevity. It may not seem as important to you 21 or 22 year old guys and gals out there, but over time, what ends up happening is we get better at whatever we practice. So if we don't practice recovering well, we're going to get compromised. We're going to get injured. Yeah. We're going to have things that happen that are not necessarily intentional, but it's because we haven't prioritized what am I putting my attention on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can think about, you know, whatever you're doing today after a workout, you are recovering from that workout as well as preparing for the next workout. And what I was something that I use to get the, 21 year olds online with this one is let's go do our workout. Let's assess throughout the workout how you're doing. And if you have one of those days that you are just killing it and you're just PRing everything that you do, it's one of those optimal days for Steve, right? Now, that's great. That's great that you did that. Now let's take a look at the last 24 hours before that moment. What did you do? And what made that performance so optimal? Because the last 24 hours is going to determine, you know, that kind of state again. So then let's try to replicate what you did. You slept 8 hours, you ate 4 meals, you know, whatever it was, you took a day off yesterday, maybe worked on some mobility. You know, all these little things come into play to like giving you the perfect equation to optimal performance. In the end, that's really what your business is about doing, is creating optimal human performance in high stress situations.
Absolutely. I think you nailed it. And looking at just retroactively, how do we arrive at an optimal performance state? What are the things that we're doing that aggregate to that state? And how do we return to it over and over? And even if we get 70 or 80% there,
yeah,
that's still a high level of performance. It's, you know, we're going to look at what are the things that are degrading or taken away from it, and what are enhancing skills and practices.
Yeah, I love that. So where can people find out more information about not only BaseR, but your company, EvenPulse?
Yeah, EvenPulse.com, EvenPulse, just like it sounds. Lots of stuff on the science of our training. There was a big DoD study done on it years ago.
Nice.
We've got lots of stuff available online. So our full military training, our law enforcement training, and a civilian universal training is available. So if anybody's spouse wants that version, it breaks out all the BaseR, takes you through it with checks on learning and all that sort of stuff. Gives you a certificate of completion at the end. And then we've also got lots of lessons and interviews. So and interviews with special operations guys.
You have some pretty famous spec ops guys too that are they're teaching skills such as shooting, right? And adding BaseR into shooting. Share some of those folks that are helping you with that.
Yeah, we've got Kyle Lambs on there, Tim Burke. Basil Baz, a CIA paramilitary guy, a bunch of other people. And you know, we work kind of a full spectrum of lessons and ideas that are useful from a tactical operational standpoint, but also kind of looking at the broader, more holistic part of life. We've got a Edie Eager, who's a Holocaust survivor, lots of different people in the tactical field, but who are looking at other aspects of recovery, et cetera. So it's kind of a full spectrum of information that you can tap.
Yeah, that's really cool, Steve. I really appreciate it. So I do appreciate you taking the time to do this. I appreciate you hiring me years ago to learn this and teach this very important topic for tactical professionals. Any final thoughts for folks? Because most people that kind of watch my stuff, we kind of have a mix of candidates, they've got the wannabe crowd, I call it, and then you got the active duty crowd that are maybe new or younger in this audience. But then, I've been doing this for over 20 years now, so some of my beginning 20-year-olds 20 years ago are now in their 40s. So I kind of got this broad spectrum of folks that are somewhere in that spectrum of tactical fitness. Any final words for those groups?
Yeah, no matter where you are in your career, whether you're a newbie and you're aspiring to wherever you want to go, or you're trying to maintain or continue to develop your skills over the course of your career, or maintain your health and well-being and longevity maybe a little bit later on, it's never too late to start to apply this stuff. You know, performance and recovery are two sides of one coin. And the more you can embrace the one, the more you're going to stay attuned to and be empowered in the other.
Oh, I like that. I like that one. Yeah. Recovery and performance, directly linked.
Absolutely.
I love it. I love it as a coin. So, Stephen, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you doing this and helping me with the bottom of that Venn diagram, because like I said, I always talk about the top side of the Venn diagram and a little bit of the bottom half of the bottoms, but you know, you really helped me nail in, you know, what the importance of stress mitigation for these, you know, tactical fitness podcasts that I've been doing for a while now. So I appreciate that. And there's so much more to learn from Stephen at the evenpulse.com website. Got to check that out. And then, you know, if you're already if you're still active duty, you know, he also does government contracting to come into your facility and train your group in all of these skill sets. So yeah, it's good training. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Stu. Appreciate you having me. And it's always great to see you.
You too, sir. And thanks again. We'll see you later.
All right. Take care.